This is the Rio Grande Room, and this is Truth, Beauty, and Goodness in Logic. So if that's the program you want to be in, you're in the right place. And if not, you won't hurt my feelings if you just sneak out the door. There's one over there and one over there. So if you're on the back four or five rows, you back row Baptists need to move up. I am Nancy Boyce, and I have taught at Regents for 6 years and loved every minute of it, and actually am making a transition in my life and going to a different school at the end of the summer, but hopefully Regents will still let me on campus because I love that school very much. So thank you for coming today, and we offer you the comfort of an indoor air-conditioned room in Texas. Okay. So I tried to stick very close to the outline that's in your notebook, and we'll see at the end how well I did. You can take a vote and see if I actually did that. The first thing I want to talk about is the student and the student's mind. In classical schools, we usually teach logic in the 7th and 8th grade or in the 9th grade. And then some schools offer a Socratics class in the 10th grade. This is the time when an adolescent is launching into a whole new realm in their life. And why in the world would we add logic into the mix for an adolescent? So that's the question I want you to consider as I go through this seminar today. So where is the truth, beauty, and goodness in trying to teach an adolescent logic when everything in their life is changing? You're aware of the changes that adolescents go through. There are those dreaded physical changes. There's the spiritual changes and the emotional changes. So let's just talk about the mental and emotional changes for just a second. Some parents tuck their lovely, sweet child into bed one night, and in the morning they walk in, and there's an alien crawling out of that bed. Okay? Their perfect, compliant child that still let daddy read to them and held hands walking into church will no longer even look at daddy. Okay? That son who would peck mom on the cheek won't even acknowledge he came from a mom and dad. There are no more calls of good night, John boy, echoing through the house. Instead, there may be doors slamming or tears in the house even. Not in your house, but in houses I've heard of around the country, of course. Okay. The immediate impact of these physical changes and these mental and emotional changes is that the adolescent's self-esteem changes. There might be moodiness. Their sleep and eating patterns change. Do you remember that? You used to go to bed and everything was safe in your house by 10 o'clock. Now you wake up in the morning and somebody has invaded your house. There's dirty dishes. The television's on. The phone is in use. Okay. Family relationships change. Peer relationships change. Questions are asked and answered that you thought you had answered long ago, and they have risen again in your home or in your classroom. In other words, everything has changed or is changing or will be changing for that adolescent. Thus, it will be changing for your family and in your classroom. The only constant in the life of most of these kids is that they still have to go to school and mom and dad still have expectations. Okay? But the adolescent is bent on challenging those expectations. There are also major changes in an adolescent's thinking and in the way they think. They are thinking about possibilities. They can consider if-then possibilities. They can move between specific and abstract to generate alternate possibilities. You know, the dreaded what-if questions. Some of those possibilities you probably do not want to know about. They are thinking about abstract concepts. They are developing the ability to comprehend higher order abstract logic. Here we go. You thought I had forgotten about logic. They are able to comprehend puns and proverbs and sarcasm, metaphors and analogy. Remember, the growth of social thinking or social cognition during adolescence is directly related to the person's improving ability to think abstractly. And that's what we want in our society. We want people who can think abstractly. You have to think abstractly in a social context to understand truth, beauty, and goodness. You have to think abstractly to think about solutions to poverty or crime or what hurts another person. If we fail to pay attention to this step in the development of an adolescent, we will have young people in their 20s and 30s who are missing their social conscience and lack the ability to understand, well, basically, let's face it, the fruits of the Spirit, which are abstract concepts. Adolescents are thinking about thinking. This is metacognition. This includes monitoring one's own thinking, increased introspection. You've seen this in teenagers. They just sit and, okay, they're really thinking. You just didn't know that. They're thinking about their own emotions. They have increased self-consciousness. They're thinking that others are thinking about them. Okay. Increased intellectualization, for the good or the bad sometimes. They're thinking about their own thoughts. This sounds a little bit like what C.S. Lewis said, if you remember. He was thinking about something, and then he was thinking about thinking, and by doing so, he totally lost the joy of the thing he was originally thinking about. Okay? One problem with all this metacognition is that adolescents believe they have an imaginary audience at all times. Everyone in the room is watching them, and the behavior in the room is the focus of everyone's concern, and it's their behavior. Okay? They also believe their own personal fable, and that is that any experience they have is unique to them. You probably remember, you were probably like the rest of us in college, you'd sit up till 4 or 5 in the morning drinking coffee and discussing philosophy, religion, and politics. We usually were discussing Marx at the college I went to. That was a long time ago. We thought we were brilliant. We were thinking about things no one had ever thought about. We were unique. We were special. So that's the same way with today's adolescents. But their buzzwords may not be Marxism, communism, socialism. Their buzzwords may be multiculturalism or tolerance or universalism. And when I say multiculturalism, I'm not referring to the fact that God created all people in his image to be equal. Okay? They are probably not thinking about truth, beauty, and goodness. These adolescents are thinking in multiple dimensions, the ability to view things in more than one aspect at a time. Their thinking is more sophisticated than it was. Again, they can understand sarcasm and double entendres, which is great for logic problems. Okay, what are those spiritual changes they're going through? Well, they see knowledge as relative. Getting into that relativism worldview here. The skepticism becomes common with many of these children. Everything may seem uncertain. No knowledge seems completely reliable. In other words, Christian parents get frightened because what they thought they had taught their children is now being questioned. And some parents and teachers, me included, sometimes feel inadequate to answer these questions for these children. Piaget said that adolescents who are questioning, and the highest form of thinking is the formal operational stage. This is where we all want to be. Now, we're not all there all the time, but hopefully that's where we want our kids to get. Once we are at that stage, then we can think about logic, propositional logic. At this stage, you can think about abstract, complicated things as well as concrete, literal things. As students learn to switch between the two types of thinking, they are given the tools to do so, and logic is the tool to switch between your operational thinking and your formal operational thinking. Parents and teachers have an opportunity to teach adolescents the process by which they are can truthfully evaluate their beliefs, their ideas, and those beliefs and ideas that they are confronted with each day and will be confronted with as they go to college. In other words, they can think about a worldview and their own worldview and how the two fit ultimate reality, because that's what we want them to do. We want them to find the truth, beauty, and goodness and the ultimate reality in God's world. You might remember Kohlberg from one of your 301 or 101 psychology classes. Kohlberg says there are three levels of morality, and within those three levels, there are six stages. And I'll give you an easy way to remember this, and you won't ever forget. So let me give you the concept first, and then as in the next few minutes as I talk, you'll be classifying every one of your previous students into one of these stages. Okay? Level one is your lowest stage of morality, and these people act just for rewards and to avoid punishment. They're really a little bit hedonistic. Level two are people who act a certain way because they want to be seen as a good girl or a good boy. They want to uphold the established social order, but they're not sure why. It's just their comfort zone, so to speak. The third level, which is the highest level of moral development, would be a person who knows what she believes or he believes and then uses those beliefs for the good of others. These people are oriented to social contacts, social contracts, and to the ethical principles which transcend the authority of law. So here's my little hint to you on how to remember this. Anybody watch the show MASH? Anybody remember that show? Okay, let's go through the characters in there. Remember, level one is your lowest level. You're just acting for the reward and to avoid the punishment. Burns. Remember Burns? Okay, he just wanted hot lips. That was his reward. He wasn't thinking about anybody else. Okay. How about hot lips? She would probably fit in level two because she wanted to be the good girl. And remember, her father was a military man and she wanted to please him. So she's acting at the level two stage. Level three, well, that would probably be BJ. Because he usually was thinking about the good of other people. He tried to keep Hawkeye out of trouble. Okay? Speaking of Hawkeye, where would he fit? He was kind of all over the place, wasn't he? Chasing a few nurses, doing a good deed, keeping Burns from really making the war worse than it was. Okay? All right, we want our children to be functional at the highest formal operational stage and in the highest level of moral development. This is where I think the Bible really says train up a teenager in the way he should go. Never mind the word child there. Logic is a means to help teenagers reach the higher orders of moral development. Truth, beauty, and goodness are those higher order concepts. Finally, their desire in a teenager's heart for control and for uniqueness. Or how to teach logic students when really what they want you to talk about is dating. Okay? So how can you convince them that they're unique, that they have a certain amount of control to lead them through the steps of logic? Well, I thought I'd give you a few of my own rules, and you can listen, and then you can just diss me. Okay? And set up your own rules. When we are trying to teach people, So the real question here is how do we go about teaching people how to defend their own worldview and their own beliefs while still making them feel in control and unique? Some of your students are probably further along in this process than others, particularly at the beginning of the school year. And then you bring them along, and they're probably very close to the same stage by the end of the school year. Right now, in here, we're participating within a set of boundaries. And you probably learned those boundaries from kindergarten on. When your teacher said, it's time to sit and listen, you dutifully sat and listened, whether it was on the rug, in the circle, or in your chair. And so today, nobody had to say, come in and sit in the chairs, ladies and gentlemen. You knew we weren't going to sit on the floor. Okay, so you learned a set of boundaries somehow in your life. This is what we try to do with these teenagers. So as they transition from 5th and 6th grade into 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th grade, we have to present those boundaries a little bit differently. As they come into the classroom, you don't stand at the door and say, I invite all of you to come sit in your little chairs. A 7th grader is just going to, you've lost it right there. You'll never have control over that classroom. Okay? So it really begins with classroom management. You have to have a managed classroom in order to convince these students that they are capable of learning logic and that they are unique, that they are beautiful, that they are wonderful, because that's not what they're thinking in their own minds. So when I start the year, I have these rules and manners posted on the board. Yes, manners. Okay. And I give each child a copy of these rules and manners. I go over the rules and the manners, and I don't smile. Okay. I want their attention. I don't want them to think that we're still in grammar school. I want them to realize they are adults in my classroom. They're the usual rules. Be in your seat on time or you're tardy. If you forget your book, that's so sad for you. It's still a tardy and you don't go get your book. Okay? I'm trying to get them to take responsibility. Raise your hand and then stand to speak. That cuts down a significant amount of clowning around and then cutting your eyes over to see if your neighbor thinks you're funny. Because if you're standing in front of the whole class and have to say it, you'll guard your words a little bit better. No late work is accepted. Work is due by 7:55 in the morning in the My Best Work box. Okay? Do not ask what page we're on. Do not ask if you can use pencil or pen. Do not ask me if we can go outside. Okay? That's a typical question because we have this beautiful plaza and this beautiful outdoor area at Regents. So I want to go outside, but we can't learn logic outside every day. Respect others, respect yourself, and respect God. Absolutely no gum chewing. If you chew gum, you receive a detention, and you have to stand and say the gum chewing cow song in front of the entire class. Anybody know the gum chewing cow song? Here goes. The gum chewing girl, the cud chewing cow. So alike, yet different somehow. Oh, I see it now. The intelligent look on the face of the cow. Okay? Nobody wants to stand and say this little song, right? So there's a very little formal gum chewing, okay? All right, my final rule is no whining. So the whining hours that I've posted on the board are between 3 and 4 a.m., okay? That cuts down on, why do we have to learn this? Why do I need to know this for the test? You know the questions. You've probably heard them. Only at this point do I ask if everyone understands the rules. Then I can use a bit of sarcasm. Remember, these are 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th graders. So with a 6th grader, you might not do this, but it's okay at this level. Okay? I usually use the no late work rule to check the cognitive development of the students in the classroom. There's always one who will just blurt out, well, what do you mean by no late work? What if? Okay? What's the first rule? Raise your hand and stand to speak. And not only do you have to stay standing, you have to stay standing the entire time I give the explanation. So that will probably be the last smarty comment that child makes. Okay? I go over why the no late work. Well, Because if you did your homework the night before and your best friend asks for it during math class, you can say, I already turned it in. It prevents you from being tempted to say to your mom, I don't feel good today, can I stay home? Everybody else has turned their paper in at 7:55 and you're home working. So how fair is that to your classmates? Okay. All right, so the child that's raised their hand and they're standing up there while I'm going through this explanation. The next question is, well, what if my dog dies and I can't get here at 7:55? That's okay. You have six sisters and one of them can bring it and turn it in by 7:55. Because everybody at Regents has at least six siblings, I'm sure. Okay? All right. Or your neighbor, or your carpool, or whatever. Okay? Well, what if I'm dead and I can't bring my logic homework in by 7:55? That's okay. While everybody else is at your funeral, I'll come into your room and get it out from underneath your bed because I know you did it. And the shocked look on a teenager's face that you would dare invade the privacy of what? Their bedroom? That child never has late work. Okay? And actually, one year I did go by someone's house and post a note on the front door that said, remember to turn your homework in tomorrow morning. That child's mother wanted to know what the note was about, and he wouldn't say, and I wouldn't say. So, okay? All right, so you see what I've done. I've now established boundaries. And these kids in the classroom have been freed from all that goofy, silly stuff they thought they were going to be able to bring into the 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. So now they have to think like an adult. They have to turn their papers in. There's no excuse. And I'm very empathetic. You know, I'm so sad you forgot that paper. And then I just stand there. I don't make any offerings. Okay, I'm so sad you forgot your book. And then we just start class. So it puts the burden where it belongs. They start discovering the truth of their own abilities and not relying on me or their mom or their big sister or whoever it is. So you've created boundaries without walls for this age group. They're now free to start thinking. Notice in my list of rules, there's very few consequences. The gum-chewing cow, you know, that girl, that song's a consequence, and the tardy for your notebook. But it allows me to have a little flexibility depending on the circumstances of that particular child or that particular family. They're still not excused from the late work policy, but it gives me a little flexibility on other policies in the classroom. For example, if one entire class has made a mistake or a certain child has made a mistake, I might say, oh, man, I'm so sorry, but you have a star in my heart anyway. What color would you like to pick? I mean, how many seventh graders think of picking a star in a teacher's heart? But if you say that, you better really remember what color that star is they have picked, because they're going to ask you later on, what color did I pick last time? And you need to know. So in the last 6 years, I've had probably three students question the late work policy and a few more parents, but usually the students are good at explaining to the parents, well, really, Mom, it wasn't late. I just didn't turn it in because I didn't feel like turning it in, or whatever the reason is, okay? So adolescents move between no feelings of self-worth and inflated feelings of self-worth. So what we're trying to do is make them feel unique enough that they can fail a little bit in logic, but still try. Because let's face it, this isn't an easy subject. Okay, let me just make sure this is going to do what it's supposed to do. Okay, there we go. All right. I'm feeding off their need to feel unique and special and loved. Sometimes I can tell one class is really having a bad day, or several people in that class. And I might say, you know what? How would y'all feel about not doing problems 10 through 20? Oh, that's great. That's great. We'd love to not do problems 10 through 20. Okay, but don't tell fourth period because they'll be really mad and they have to do it. What do they immediately do when they leave the room? We don't have to do problems 10 through 20, right? So fourth period comes in and says, well, how come we have to do it? And I'll just be brutally honest. It's because I love third period more today. I'll love you more tomorrow. But don't forget, you have to love third period more tomorrow. You have to keep drawing them in logic class. Okay? Honoring the desires of their heart. Where do they come from and where are they going? Two primary questions that we all ask. We call them worldview questions. They don't know that at the beginning of the year, but they will by the end of the year. Okay. They need to have a stable peer group. They need to feel comfortable in the classroom. They need to find ways that they can prove themselves. Unlike preschoolers or your first and second grade students, you can't pull these kids onto your lap to soothe hurt feelings or tears, so you have to find other ways. You have to figure out what they want and what they need in order to keep them engaged. So let me just give you a few techniques to keep them moving in logic. Tell them that you heard this was the most brilliant class that ever came through the school. They don't have to know you tell every class that every year. Just tell them. Their faces will just light up for you, okay? Use real life when you're giving examples in your classroom. But you have to stay ahead of them because don't use an antiquated example with them. So, for example, I have teenagers, and I have to discipline my teenagers. And sometimes my teenagers, unlike your teenagers, make wrong choices. So my daughter got her driver's license at the age of 15. She had just turned 15. And she announced that she would drive on the freeway at night over to Zilker Park to see the Christmas tree by herself. I didn't think that was a real great idea for somebody the first week they had their license, driving on Mopac in the dark, parking in a dark area, and walking to a Christmas tree where there's a lot of things going on under that lighted Christmas tree. I had my class help me to solve the problem with my daughter using logic. We actually drew out the square of opposition. Well, what if we do this? Well, what's the reaction? What if we do this? Okay, so use real life examples with them. Ask them to solve dilemmas for you. Okay. I was attending a seminary this past 3 years, and several of the people there didn't really believe in Jesus, but they were at the seminary, and they couldn't figure out why they felt so rattled inside. Well, that was easy for me to explain to them, but that wouldn't have been logical. They need to figure it out. So I asked my students, why do you think these people are attending a seminary when they don't really believe that Jesus is the Savior? So they got to start working on real life problems. Ask your students their opinions and then ask if-then questions. Turn it around on them. Okay? Teach them to debate. Oh boy, parents are going to love you for this one. Okay? Give them credit for well thought out arguments, even if you disagree with their premise. But if it's well thought out, give them credit for it, and then lead them through to a different way of thinking if you need to. Find any way you can into their heads. 2 years ago, I had a student that came into the room with a very bad reputation among the teachers. But I had watched him the year before and watched his behavior in the classrooms surrounding mine. And I had figured this kid out. He wanted to be needed, and he wanted to be unique. So the first day he came into the classroom, I said, Charlie, that's your seat right back there at the very back corner by the door, and you're in charge of the stapler and the tape and the garbage can. Everything in this room has to be picked up because nobody gets to leave until you say so. And that stapler better be working all the time, and there better be tape in that dispenser. He never caused a bit of trouble in my room. Okay, silly jobs for an eighth grader. But you know what? He had a notorious reputation for taking the desks apart while he sat in class, for breaking every stapler in the school. Okay? So I just put him in charge of it. Okay? And nobody left until he said it was okay to leave. So all those hole punches that get all over your floor, there weren't any on my floor that year because he made everybody pick them up. I was the nice guy. I didn't have to say anything. Right? So get into their heads, whatever it takes. Allow them privacy. Okay? If you're going to honor their uniqueness, allow them some privacy. I allow them to leave little secret notes on my desk if somebody's bothering them or asking to see their homework or if there's a prayer request, and then I never show those to anybody. Okay? I even say to them, look, you're not going to be happy with me every day, and it is fine if you go to your locker, open it up, and scream into it, I cannot stand Mrs. Boyce, okay, and then shut your locker. I'm not going to go in your locker and see what you've said about Mrs. Boyce. That's your private place. Now, notice I didn't say that I wouldn't have to come in their locker sometime to get the stinky sandwich out that everybody else in the hallway was smelling, or, you know, whatever reasons you have that you have to go in a child's locker sometimes. But it did let them know they had some privacy in that area. If they do something wrong outside your classroom, my suggestion is don't allow someone to pull them out of your class, your logic class, to discipline them. Whatever they've done outside your class is outside your class. They need to be in logic class. And you know what? It's really more of a penalty to have to stay after school and then explain to coach why you weren't dressed out for football on time and let them deal with their discipline problems or other problems after school. Because then not only has someone else gotten on to them, but coach is now on to them. So it makes logic class a safe place to be. Okay, truth, beauty, and goodness, the practical side. How it works. Teach the formulas and the methods in the first part of the year. And I've used several logic books, and I have one in particular I just love because it's easy for a 7th and 8th grader to understand the way it's laid out. And then as you're teaching those concepts, throw in examples and discussions from a current topic from another class. Okay, so at Regents, the 8th graders read Night by Elie Wiesel in October. And by October, we've covered the square of opposition. They are getting ready to go into the English language fallacies in November. So we're kind of in that transition point. Night is the autobiographical story of Elie Wiesel's internment in Auschwitz. By mid-October, because the kids are really trained to have a Socratic dialogue, I pose the question, is it ever right to use human beings for medical research? Okay, think about that question. It has so many facets to it. Our church kids will automatically say, oh, no, never. But there's always several kids who will say, well, wait a minute. What if what we find out from that will save 10,000 lives or a million lives? Or so the discussion starts, and then you're on your way to discussing worldview and truth, beauty, and goodness at a level that's outside just logic formulas, but in the real world for them. Because those are discussions that are going on right now in our world, and it relates back to Night by Elie Wiesel, okay, what happened at Auschwitz. This question has led to discussions about ethics, morality, right to life, right to die, rights and responsibilities in general. It's a great question for eighth graders. And I can say that because I didn't think it up myself. So, all right. This is also a great way of introducing relativism and utilitarianism. It's very easy. They've got it now from two classes, and the history class is about at the same place. And so you've got three classes all feeding into logic for them. Okay. All right, the other text that I use to take examples from is Jane Eyre. I tell the boys that Jane Eyre has some really nasty women in it that you don't want to take home to mom. Okay. And if you remember the story, it really does. Remember Blanche Ingram? Who wants her for a best friend? Okay. And remember, the nice girl gets her man in Jane Eyre. So the girls like it too. Another story that they identify with is To Kill a Mockingbird. This is a novel that addresses family values, love, community, racism, religious prejudice, truth, with a capital T, beauty and goodness. And if you haven't read this book in a while, please do so. Remember, those of you that have read it recently, remember, contrary to what some people believe, there is no rape in To Kill a Mockingbird. If you want to use the word rape, the real only rape that occurs is the rape of Tom's life in To Kill a Mockingbird. Another excellent book is The Chosen. Excellent book for teaching truth, beauty, and goodness. And one of the boys in the book actually loves logic and is studying logic in his school. Okay, so what to do? Consider teaching the basics of logic, but add in worldview teaching. Provide students with a chart of false truth claims so that they can see that there are solid logical arguments and responses to those false claims. For example, the claim, there are no absolutes. Really? Are you absolutely sure about that? Okay. Another truth claim, false truth claim. All roads lead to God. Oh, well, this isn't what the Bible says, and if you don't believe in the Bible, check the Quran. Okay. God is indescribable beyond the reach of our puny language and logic. Well, isn't that a description of God in plain language? Okay. This may be true for you, but it's not true for me. Oh, is that statement true for me, but not for you? Okay. They love to play with these false truth claims, and it fits right in with logic. There's a DVD of a PBS discussion led by Dr. Armin Nicolai, and the title of it is Does God Exist? If you haven't seen it or don't own it, it is well worth giving up an extra gallon of gas to get this DVD. This DVD has a panel discussion. Not everyone on that panel is Christian, and I make the students pick out the worldview of each panelist. It's a comparison of the life of Sigmund Freud and C.S. Lewis, and then the panelist discussion goes through the is intertwined throughout the video. It's fascinating, fascinating, and your students can actually think through the worldviews and use their logic knowledge. Show it after Christmas, though. Get through your fallacies, your informal fallacies, before Christmas. I do have to warn you about part of the video. Depending on the school that you are in, part of it does go into Freud's psychosexual stages. And, of course, there's the usual giggles and uncomfortableness in the classroom. And if you pre-screen it, you can just zip past that part. It's very short. Okay. By the time they get to Freud and why he left Nazi Germany and moved into England, they understand why that discussion was in the video. Okay. Other useful products. The Chair by Frank Peretti. It's a DVD. Part of the video series How Now Shall We Live by Chuck Colson. The first complete video, and I don't know if it's out in DVD form yet, is a great story about a teenager rejecting God. She even comes complete with a nose piercing. So, you know, everybody thinks it's a real story. The acting's kind of cheesy, but it's great and ripe for discussion if you want to use that. Most the movie, M-O-S-T, Most the movie. Screen this ahead of time, and you have to judge the maturity level of your students and the emotional level. It's the story about a father's love for his son, and I'm going to spoil it for you. The son is killed, and then the father is able to pull his life back together. It's all done in subtitles. It's a fabulous, fabulous movie for discussing worldview with your students and the love and beauty of parenthood. Another series is the Anchors Away series by Nancy Fitzgerald. She has several guest speakers on the DVD, included with the teaching materials. One of the speakers is a girl who has actually returned from college and is talking to the audience about her experience in college and how she had to defend her faith to a professor who gave her a lower grade on a paper than the other students in the class. Okay. Another speaker is a man who was raised in Lebanon, and is a Muslim scholar, although he is not Muslim, has read the Quran at least 7 times cover to cover, which is probably more than most of the imams have read it. And he explains clearly how to talk to a Muslim about God and uses logic in this video. It's great to hear him talk. And of course, your Ravi Zacharias DVDs are excellent. Enron, the documentary. Has anybody seen this? The documentary, The Smartest Guys in the Room? Okay. If you haven't seen it, it's well worth your purchase to analyze the ethics and the morality in this documentary, the people that worked at Enron. I have to warn you again, there's a certain part of the documentary that you need to skip over when it discusses Mr. Powell and his addiction to pornography. The producers of the movie put some of the footage of Mr. Powell at a pornographic show in the movie. It's very fuzzy, but you really don't want to show that to your students. They put that in there. They were called on the carpet for putting this in there. And they really put it in there to show the lack of ethics is more than just the lack of business ethics for many people. It's the lack of morality and ethics in your treatment of your fellow human beings. So, another series is Rewired, and I'm going to show you part or a few clips from Rewired here in a minute. And that one's produced by Teen Mania, M-A-N-I-A, Teen Mania, and Chuck Colson. You can order it from Breakpoint Ministries. Okay. Next section. The Necessity of Blood, Sweat, and Tears. I love this subtitle. I stole it from a famous musician. Okay. How does this apply to my life? Well, after you've taught the informal fallacies, that knowledge can be applied to real life. And luckily for us here in Texas, we have something to vote on every November. We love to vote. Well, at least we love to talk about voting. I'm not sure how much we actually get out and vote. So arriving in your mailbox starting from September to November are all these campaign flyers. Remember these that come and you probably throw them in the trash? Don't throw them in the trash. Save them. This is our project from November through January. So I have the students do several things. They have to record a campaign commercial, one or two. They have to collect these campaign flyers, and then we start analyzing them. We analyze them for fallacies, for propaganda, for truth, for opinion. We look at the types of pictures that are used on them. We compare the campaign flyers that go to one side of town or the other side of town or to one socioeconomic group or another socioeconomic group. We look for colors. We look for print size. We look for the verbiage. Okay? And then we do the same thing in the commercials. Then we create posters about each candidate for public office. So this year was great. We had a lot to work with. And they have to have 3 parts on those posters. They have to have what the candidate says about herself or himself. They have to have what the media says about that candidate. And they have to say a section on what the general public says about that candidate. Okay? And then they have to pick out the lack of truthfulness or the presence of truthfulness in those posters. And I give them the websites to go to for the campaign finance records, the voting records, the congressional records, who sponsored the bills. Did they really sponsor that? Is their name anywhere on it? Okay. All right. So this is real life. This is the good, bad, and the ugly. This is the blood, sweat, and tears. Assign your students to analyze television. They love this because I say, you have to watch television. Tell your parents you have to watch television. Okay? They have to watch a situation comedy and count the number of laugh tracks that are played in a 5-minute period. They have to analyze the situation comedy. What's really being said? Can you really hear what's being said? Is it really funny? Is it edifying to other people, or is it simply putting down other people? Okay? How are parents treated? How are the elderly treated? How are people who are overweight or underweight treated? Okay, so you can see where I'm going with this. I want them to use their logic to look for truth, beauty, and goodness in the real world. Okay. They also have to watch a 30-minute news program and analyze the commercials. They have to watch a religious program. They have to watch a documentary. Okay. Sometimes I'll let them choose to watch cartoons and analyze the cartoons that were on 30 years ago or 40 years ago compared to what we have now. Over the years, I've had parents tell me that I ruined television for their family. So, oh well, so sad. Okay. One warning for you, if you start analyzing websites with your students, which I also do, we analyze websites, and I assign them, or they pick a controversial topic, such as abortion or stem cell research to analyze. Tell your parents to sit with them while they analyze these websites, because they will pull up inappropriate websites tied to very valid websites. But you want them to analyze these websites. Who sponsors the website? Who's paying for the website? Is the expert really an expert? How do you know? So they learn to trace it back to who posted, who's financing this particular issue. And it's interesting for them to see that not everything on the internet is true. Okay. All right. In the second semester, we talk a lot about current issues. For example, whether elderly people should have the right to health care. Okay. Is stem cell research moral or ethical? How many resources should be used for the homeless? Are Christians obligated to safeguard the environment? And every year I just make up new questions depending on the class and what I've listened to in the hallways or outside. The end of the year exam, I never give a logic comprehensive exam out of the book or a work these problems exam because, we'll shut the doors before I say this, I don't really care if they can work every problem. I care if they can think, okay? But don't leave here and tell all the Regent students that Mrs. Boyce doesn't care about the final exam. So the final exam is an essay question or questions. And it's usually something along the lines of select a worldview and compare it to Christianity in the areas of truth, beauty, and goodness. So they have to know their worldviews. They can use their notes, their own personal notes, not someone else's notes that they faxed around the night before. Okay. They can use their logic book. They can use anything they've learned all year. They can use their Bible. But I want them to think about worldview, and I want them to think about Christianity and you actually use what they've learned in logic. If you're doing this, you're going to have to educate yourself about PETA and Dr. Peter Singer and a lot of worldview issues that you might not normally want to read about. Okay, but it will really enhance your logic class. So my purpose is not to have a controversial class. My purpose is to make them start thinking within the boundaries, without walls, in a comfortable environment. And I just want them to leave logic class knowing that they can think. They can actually do something their parents can't do, which is work a few logic problems. Okay? They actually know what the square of opposition is, and not many people really know that. Okay? All right. Teach your students to debate. I use a modified form of Lincoln Douglas and a modified form of cross-examination debate. If you go to the National Forensic League website or the Texas Forensic League website, you can basically order materials that will help you become at least schooled enough in debate to teach this form of debate. Okay. I use controversial subjects such as resolved, a teenager's right to privacy ought to be valued above a parent's right to know. Ooh. Did y'all understand what I just said? Okay. All right. At first, they all want to be on the affirmative side. Okay. And then they realize this isn't such an easy side after all. And they have to know their topic in order to defend it. And truth comes out in this topic. Okay. And usually those people that wanted the affirmative side are not so sure they wanted that affirmative side by the time the negative side gets finished with them. Another resolution, the federal government should reform health care policies to provide for adequate health care for every person in the United States. So this makes them think about economics. It makes them think about who is a person in the United States? What is adequate health care? What is health care? Is this the federal government's responsibility? What is the federal government? So I've pulled in their history class, too, by doing this. The need for hope and laughter. Keep the perspective. Not everybody is going to be on the same page you are. Allow them to have their differences of opinion. Logic is an excellent witnessing tool, not only for you in the classroom, but for them as they go out. You're not going to convince someone to believe in Jesus by screaming at them, you're going to go to hell if you don't believe in Jesus. Okay? It just doesn't work like that. I'm trying to teach these students, and I know you are too, how to talk to someone about an issue they're interested in and bring the talk around to Jesus. Okay? To get that truth, beauty, and goodness into place. Finally, the last thing I do with them is at Easter, have them read The Case for Easter by Lee Strobel. It's a very short book. Even if you have to pay for it yourself, it's well worth giving your students a copy. By the time they get to the medical evidence for the crucifixion, they know what witnessing is. They can talk to other people about Jesus. They see Jesus as the man with and as a son and as the Son of God. Finding truth and goodness in logic. Well, advice for the teacher. Give of yourself, be open to ideas with which you disagree. Listen, listen, listen. For the student, well, they're going to surprise you anyway, so I don't need to talk about that. The future. What we really are trying to do in teaching logic and in teaching in Christian classical schools is to train students to think for the future. We're trying to train them to pass on everything that we can teach them. And isn't this exactly what Jesus told the disciples to do? Go out and pass on everything I've taught you. Okay? So the first question I asked you today was, is there logic behind teaching logic to adolescents? I hope you've taken that question to the next level and are asking, where is the logic in not teaching logic to adolescents? How can we possibly educate or claim to educate children if we do not teach them to understand absolute truth, absolute goodness, and absolute beauty? So 2 Corinthians 10:5 says, we demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, and we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. I want to play this DVD for you, just a part of it. And once again, it's from Teen Mania. This series is called Rewired. Thank you.
so I'm going to eat the oatmeal in the middle, right? And I'm like, thinking the oatmeal in the middle looks just about right. You know, it's not too hot, it's not too cold, but it's not my oatmeal. I mean, I'm trespassing. It's like not my bed or my chair or nothing. But okay, so I'm going to eat the oatmeal in the middle, and then all of a sudden I hear this loud voice above me. It's like telling me to eat the oatmeal in the middle, and I'm like, but I don't want to eat the oatmeal in the middle. If you're going to tell me loudly to eat the oatmeal in the middle, like you're the boss of me or something.
And who was that voice?
Who else could it be? The storybook author.
Once upon an uprising, all was happily ever altered, as the characters in the most beloved tales of our childhood have gone on strike, revolting against the author of their story for the rights to write their own story. I'm Chip Hardman, and can there be a storybook ending with no storybook?
No, that's when Goldie just, like, wigged out and stuff, you know? She says, ain't nobody gonna tell me what to do. You know, she's sassy like that, you know what I'm saying? And so she goes, I'm not going to do the exact opposite stuff.
And that's when she ate the porridge that was too cold.
Yeah, and she got food poisoning.
Ouch.
And you're the wolf.
Maybe.
Well, you don't look anything like a wolf.
I may have had some plastic surgery.
But she didn't stop there. Goldilocks also slept in the bed that was too soft. Now she has a crick in her neck as well as salmonella poisoning. Red Riding Hood diverted from her intended path in order to visit the ailing Goldilocks, who has since dyed her hair black and created all new definitions for the term projectile vomiting. Due to this fact, there was no one nearby to protect Red's grandmother, and now Riding Hood lives in denial that her grandmother has actually been eaten by and replaced with the wolf in disguise. Due to the fact that the wolf was not killed, as the story originally had played out, he has now bought out the mortgage company that holds the note to the three pigs' brick house and evicted them. The pigs, in turn, have fled to the castle where they're terrorizing Cinderella, who is a vegetarian. Everyone wants the story their own way, but when no one's story coincides with the rhythm of anyone else's, all is chaos.
Now, what's your nickname up there?
Well, actually, Big Bad is my nickname. My birth name is Wolf Blitzer.
So BB is a stage name. Big Bad is a stage name.
I don't know if you'd say stage name so much as nom de plume. You know, that's French for name de plume.
No, when you're performing. Now you perform, is that right?
Yeah, I am a performer. I like to call it, I like performance art, actually. What I do is I will do a little tap dance with some of my friends, and then I will carve them and eat them.
I refuse to be held responsible for what happened to the pigs or Red's gram-gram. I'm only responsible for myself. But how can I do that with this voice constantly telling me to do something different than what I feel like?
But if it's the author's story to begin with, wouldn't you want to know what he thinks?
Why would I want to know that?
Well, he kind of created you. Once our beloved characters discovered they were fiction and had been able to hear the author all along if they had only listened, they became confused and angry. Why? Because they believe they could write just as successful a story themselves. However, one figure in the forest disagreed. He is a young man who has been to the skies and found that the voice is worth listening to. His name is Jack. You believe the story was just fine how it was?
Well, let's be honest. Who knows where the story is going? That's part of the thrill. But if I have the choice between the one being in power being myself, or someone with a bigger picture? Why would I choose someone as blind as me?
I don't follow you.
Sure, if I got my own way, I'd be free to write my own story. That's not real freedom. Freedom is choosing to be who you are meant to be. The author created my story just for me, and I've chosen to fulfill my destiny.
So you like pork, do you?
Well, no, I'm Jewish, but No, I just hate to waste anything.
Let's discuss the plastic surgery, then.
The what?
Plastic surgery, maybe. It's obvious you've had some work done.
There's nothing plastic. I have... That's a lie. I don't know where you've read that. I've never heard anything about it, and I deny all plausibility. Maybe, and I can explain it as well.
The publications, the photographs. I've seen your snout.
See, it's overstated. See what some people would call blemish, other people would call a nose protrusion with whiskers. And I would say I've had a deep skin condition that makes me look like I have no snout when I once looked like I had a snout.
Much more human now.
Well, you've seen a magic eye painting. You squint, you let your eyes laze, you see dolphins jumping. Are they there? No. My snout is now...
But you were hairy. You had a snout. You had fangs.
See,
explain it.
There's something we need to call Nair.
And without surgery, some intervention.
I'm not saying anything that I've just said is true. I'm just saying that I'm denying that I've said it.
So you have rejected the author and instead chosen a life of creative license.
That is correct.
Are you happy?
I'm pretty sure that Fairy World is definitely better off, maybe. I mean... Yeah, I'm up-checking on an every 5-minute basis, and my name doesn't match my hair, and I can't move my head. But I'm in control. They may be bad decisions, but they're mine.
So you have refused the plan of the author.
See, now, Jip, how do we even know that there is an author? You know what I'm saying? How do we know?
So you believe this fairy tale world just wrote itself, then?
Yes, you see, I believe that this book just happened in a massive explosion of the alphabet as several cosmic typewriters simultaneously collided together into space at the same time.
And who made those typewriters, BB?
I hate you.
But you don't even know the whole story. You don't know where your character's going. You hardly know the real you. He knows all of that. His story is full... of the most wonderful and scary twists and turns. But in the end, we will become the real us.
Perhaps it would be better if instead of trying to create your own story, you simply discover the story the author has already created just for you.
But my story has really cute outfits.
2 months after the debate, Fairy World is in ruins. Its inhabitants have moved on to books they never belonged in. Only Jack remains with his ear to the sky, hoping to piece together some semblance of a new chapter. For everyone else, all is destroyed, and nothing is what they wished for. In short, this ain't no fairy tale. I'm Jip Hardner. Good day.
Okay, so you can see how this would probably be effective with eighth graders at getting the discussion going about truth, beauty, and goodness, and logic in general. So thank you, and your students are very blessed to have you as teachers. I hope you enjoy the rest of the weekend here at the ACCS conference.